Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo.
And tonight we're here to bring you some news, and then followed by our interview of Ellen Brown, who's a lawyer, and she's going to talk about her book, The Web of Debt. She's going to tell us how we got into the economic mess, and she's also going to tell us how to get out.
Yeah.
Lots of complaints on the mainstream TV, but with no solutions. She has the solution.
Oh, we'll be talking about that tonight. Bring her up. We got about a 40-minute interview with her.
Yeah, she was really good.
And
very informative.
Yeah. A couple of things that hit the news today. I like this. I'll be there for you. Bush offers to help President Obama.
Oh, my gosh. You've got to be kidding.
Ex-president makes Canada's first port of call in the public. George Bush wants Barack Obama to know that he's there if he needs him. If he wants my help, he can pick up the phone for a former president. It's funny that he hasn't bothered picking up the phone since he's been in office. Know that he's there if he needs him. If he wants my help, he can pick up the phone, the former president said, noted helpfully this week during an affable speech to the business community of Calgary in Canada, his first paid speaking engagement since leaving the White House in January. Well, up to 400 demonstrators chanted and threw shoes outside the venue, though police disabled a makeshift cannon rigged to fire shoes into the street.
How cool is that?
I love Canadians.
I hope Bush isn't holding his breath awaiting Obama's call.
Well, Bush steered clear of any criticism of his successor. It's funny that no mainstream media picked that up. Isn't that funny how they're protecting Bush? You know, even now. And up to 400 demonstrators chanted through shoes outside the venue. Police disabled a makeshift cannon rigged to fire shoes into the street. Bush steered clear of the criticism. I want the president to succeed, he said. I love my country a lot more than I love politics. I'm not going to spend my time criticizing. There are plenty of critics in that arena. And Bush's stance was in sharp contrast to the former Vice President Dick Cheney, who used the TV interview at the weekend to launch a wide-ranging attack on Obama, saying his policies had exposed America to a greater risk of terrorist attack. Bush said the president deserves my silence, and if he sure does, and if he wants my help, he can pick up the phone and call me. Obama was not my first choice for president, but when he won, I thought it was good for the United States, he added. But he did warn against relying on government to solve the economic problems. It's the risk takers, not the government, that's going to pull us out of this recession. It was the risk takers that got us into this recession.
Yeah, you didn't get it.
A lunchtime event billed a conversation with George Bush cost the audience more than $1,500 1,500 people, $400 a head. The ex-president reportedly earned $150,000 from what he called his maiden voyage in post-presidential employment, joining the other living ex-presidents on a lucrative circuit that earned Bill Clinton $40 million in his first six years after leaving office. When asked about Iraq, he was as hard as ever he's ever been, one attendee told the Toronto Star. He said, I'm absolutely convinced I'm right and the other arguments don't hold. Police arrested 4 protesters. Anyway, so George Bush is still raking it in. I mean, I can't believe people are paying this guy. They owe him a lot of favors. That's what that's all it is. Just amazing that anybody's paying this jerk to talk. U.S. kicks Iran war prep into high gear. 3 killed in Iraq unrest.
Blackwater still working for the U.S. in Iraq.
Yeah, and they just paid him $70 million. Obama quietly gave Blackwater $70 million in February.
They have a new deal of $22.2 million deal in February to keep the embattled contractor working there through most of the summer. Contract records show The decision keeps Blackwater, since renamed XE in Iraq, months longer than anyone had suggested publicly, while raising questions about why the U.S. would pay a contractor terrorist for work in Iraq if it may not be able to operate there legally. Oh, pay, what does that mean?
Where are you reading?
Right here.
Oh, you went down. Oh, okay.
Would pay, why the U.S. would pay terrorists for work if they crossed out the word contractor.
This is, we're
for work in Iraq. Well, you've just,
legit gov,
I'm trying to read that.
Okay, okay.
Would pay terrorists for work in Iraq if it may not be able to operate there legally. I don't know exactly what the rest of that article has to say. We could go to it and see.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Well, I'd like to clarify it.
Where is it? Which one?
It's right there, that one. Yeah.
Right. State Department has been under pressure from Blackwater critics, including several in Congress, not to renew the company's contract in Iraq, but the concern stems from a 2007 incident left 14 Iraqi civilians dead and six former Blackwater guards facing manslaughter charges. One of the guards pleaded guilty, but the company was accused of no wrongdoing in the incident.
I don't understand that.
Well, you know.
In late February, the Iraqi government said it would not renew Blackwater's operating license and that the company would have to leave as soon as a joint Iraqi-U.S. committee completes its work on guidelines for the operation of private security companies. State Department officials said they would honor the decision. On February 2nd, a department spokesman was asked whether officials plan to renew one of Blackwater's contracts past May. The spokesman, Robert Wood, said the department had told Blackwater, "We do not plan to renew the company's existing task force orders for protective security details in Iraq." But records available through the Federal Procurement Database showed that on the same day, the State Department approved a $22.2 million contract modification for Blackwater security personnel in Iraq with a job completion date of September 3, 2009. Why would you continue to use Blackwater when the Iraqi government has banned the highly controversial company and there are other choices? Asked Melanie Sloan, Executive Director of the Nonpartisan Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. A very good question. State Department spokesman Noel Clay said the contract modification involves aviation services. The place of performance is Iraq, but is totally different than the Baghdad one that expires in May. Oh, what a bunch of double talk that is.
They're still paying this horrible company.
Terrible company. Double speak.
Clinton Obama tussle over Blackwater. Let's see. Senator Hillary Clinton's Senate office announced late Thursday that she is co-sponsoring a bill to ban Blackwater and other private mercenary firms in Iraq.
Good.
The timing of the announcement is particularly curious. It comes less than a day after the elected Obama will not rule out after the... Wait a minute. It comes less than a day after the investigative journalist and Blackwater critic Jeremy Scahill published a piece called In the Nation reporting that if elected, Obama will not rule out using private security like Blackwater World, blah, 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 blah. The campaign also informed Scahill that Obama would be signing on to, okay, this, this was written in February 08. All right, that particular one, but they were bringing it up to point out that Obama said he wouldn't rule out using private security firms.
Well, here's an interesting one. Oops, looks like a little PSYOPs Project oneself. People are asking questions. Who sent soldiers into an Alabama town last week? The 131-year-old Federal Posse Comitatus Act generally prohibits federal military personnel or federalized National Guard from taking on domestic law enforcement roles. On the 18th of March, 2009, who sent 22 military police and an Army officer into the tiny Alabama town of Sampson last week after a gunman went on a rampage that left 11 people dead? That's what the U.S. Army would like to know. The Associated Press reports that an Army spokesman says the military has launched an inquiry to find out what happened, why the troops were sent from nearby Fort Rucker, and what they did while they were there and whether any federal laws were broken.
That's kind of weird, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Army reviews domestic use of troops. Okay. Let's see. I don't believe this, but AIG will repay taxpayers for bonuses, Geithner says. The Treasury will deduct that amount from the $30 billion taxpayer bailout that will soon go to the company unless we stop them. The foolishness there is that, you know, they're gonna pull that out of the $30 billion. They're still gonna get the $30 billion, all right, and then still pay them pay them the bonuses. They put $165 billion less into their coffers.
Uh-huh.
The Treasury Department will order failed insurance giant American International Group to repay the taxpayers the $165 million that the company is giving employees as bonuses. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner said Tuesday in a letter to the congressional leaders, Geithner said the government can't block the payments, which are being made under illegal contracts signed before the government stepped in with $173 billion to prevent AIG from going bankrupt.
Government launches bid to allay fears over GM, genetically modified food. PM, I guess this is in Britain, PM hopes to fabricate enough evidence to prove genetically modified crops are safe. The government has asked its top scientists to investigate the merits of genetically modified food in the hope that his verdict will allay public fears about the so-called Frankenstein foods. Officially, Gordon Brown and his ministers remain neutral on the issue of genetically modified because of public hostility, but they have quietly ordered a major research project which they hope will provide the launch pad for a campaign to persuade people that genetically modified food is safe.
Right. And business, business collapse can end union contracts, but not AIG bonus contracts. And contracts guaranteeing bonuses to executives at collapsing businesses like American International Group or AIG are held inviolable, while labor union contracts regularly get violated or reneged on when corporations declare or even threaten bankruptcy. Labor experts say it's the law of the land. And today, President Obama told Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner to find a way to stop AIG, which took in $170 billion in public bailout funds from paying $165 million in executive bonuses. But even if Geithner succeeds, management preeminence in law will remain deeply seated in the American legal system. The most local and recent examples of workers whose contracts became casualties to corporate collapse are the Star Tribune pressmen. Only by caving to concession demands on Friday did they avoid having a bankruptcy judge void their contract. The week began a new horizon. The negotiation of the Star Tribune burned through as much as $11 million in court battle with the rival Pioneer Press defending Par Ritter, the publisher who in 2007 oversaw half a year of the newspaper's hurtle toward insolvency. As University of Minnesota Professor John Budd tells the Minnesota Independent, it comes down to who calls the bankruptcy shots. I imagine that AIG could void its executive bonus contracts if it filed for bankruptcy. But you have executives making the decisions whether or not to file for bankruptcy, so the right incentives are not there. And other experts say contrasting contract situations are only part of the picture. The real matter is one of the different ways that workers are treated in this economic crunch from the way executives are treated, law or no law. I have commented on this issue for many years in my classes. This is James Scoble, who teaches ethics and labor relations. Lost my place here. Scola cites a maxim of Jim. This is just gets on and on for nothing. Anyway, not a good thing for. Not a good thing. They can still void it, but there's no incentive to void it, so. What are you going to do? Grassley dismisses suicide talk as rhetoric. In an interview with MSNBC's David Schuster, Senator Grassley didn't apologize for a comment that AIG representatives should either resign go commit suicide. Instead, he dismissed the question, saying people should know rhetoric when they hear it. I hope you recognize rhetoric, Grassley said, and I shouldn't even have to answer that question.
11 AIG workers who receive retention bonuses of 1 million or more have already left the company. So much for the retention bonus. Since they weren't retained, get it back.
It was revealed today as Congress threatened to reduce new taxes to claw back under $65 billion payment. Lawmakers competed yesterday to rain down the harshest criticism on AIG and received more than $70 billion in assistance from taxpayers after it handed out bonuses to 400 staff at the financial products division that caused its near collapse.
Oh, my God. Well, anyway, we're on to the interview with Ellen, is Ellen Brown, who's a lawyer, financial expert, and she's going to tell us all about this and explain why we're in this economic mess.
Yeah.
And she's going to explain how to get out of it. So, Leo, do you have that interview ready?
Yeah, I do. I just was looking to see if there's anything
else. It's all the same thing over and over again. Everybody is outraged about AIG. Okay, we have the outrage. Let's get over it and let's move on. Get those bonuses back and let's fix the problem.
Okay.
We're just getting mired in problems with no solutions. That's what I don't like. I want to fix it. And this is how, and here's a person who knows how to fix it. And that's where we should spend our time thinking. And that's what you should be emailing your representatives and senators and congresspeople, because they don't know what to do. They don't seem to be very well informed. And if they are, they're not acting on good information.
I just wanted to read this because I saw it yesterday and I didn't pull it up, but new generation on nuclear power stations risks terrorist anarchy. Plan for more nuclear power stations increases the risk of terrorists seizing plutonium, report warns. A new generation of atomic power stations planned for Britain, China, and many other parts of the world risk proliferation that could lead to nuclear anarchy, a security expert warned in the report published today. Governments and multilateral organizations must come up with a strategy to deal with the impact of the new nuclear age, which will produce enough plutonium to make 1 nuclear or 1 million nuclear weapons by 2075, argues Frank Barnaby from Oxford Research Think Tank in a paper, Institute of Public Policy Research. And Lila and I are dead set against nuclear power.
Absolutely.
We have been for many, many years. But
there's so many other kinds of safe power.
Yeah, and it's just a hoax on the public, I'll tell you, and around the world to use. It's kind of unsafe.
Just another money-making scheme that screws
the public. The public is insuring these things as well as funding these things.
And naive about it. That's like also what the pharmaceutical companies are doing.
That's right.
Selling you drugs that hurt you when you could use something natural or something much less expensive that wouldn't hurt you.
That's right.
Or giving you a flu inoculation that you don't need that causes you to have the flu and get sick.
Right. So we are going to play this interview with Ellen Brown, author of The Web of Debt. And it's about 40 minutes.
Interesting.
Yeah. And we'll be back right after that.
He's actually a lawyer and a financial expert, who has plunged in, you might say, where many others fear to tread. She learned her skills practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. Brown developed an interest in the developing world and its problems while living abroad in Kenya, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. She returned to practicing law when she was asked to join the legal team of a Tijuana healer with an innovative cancer therapy who was targeted by the chemotherapy industry in the 1990s. That experience produced the book Forbidden Medicine. Brown has written 11 other books, actually, and her latest book is The Web of Death. And she talks about the Federal Reserve and Well, it's actually like a Ponzi scheme, and I'm going to ask her to explain that to us. And she's going to talk about how we've gotten into the problem that we're in. And she also has some solutions for the problems that we're in, which is always refreshing because lots of times on the mainstream media, people talk about all the problems, but lately I haven't heard too many solutions or a real clear explanation of the economic problems. Ellen, are you with us?
I am.
Oh, good. Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show.
Thanks.
Good. I just introduced you and told a little bit about you, that you've actually written 11 books, and your latest one is The Web of Debt, and we're hoping that you can make it all clear to us in the short time that we're having you on. The Federal Reserve is actually, and the money system is really just a big Ponzi scheme, isn't it?
The whole banking system is a Ponzi scheme in the sense that all of our money is created privately in the form of loans. There's no real money in our system. So banks issue. People think that when banks make a loan, they are lending either their money or their depositors' money, but that's not true. When a bank makes a loan, it creates the money that it lends on its books. It does it by double-entry bookkeeping, so it enters it as an asset and a liability to itself at the same time. I can go into that. But anyway, basically, banks lend the principal, but they don't lend the interest necessary to pay off their loans. So more money is always owed back to the banking system as a whole than exists in the system. So to find that extra money, someone somewhere has to be taking out yet another loan. So to keep this whole scheme going, you have to have continually be finding more and more borrowers. So this scheme has gone on since the Bank of England was founded in 1694. It's gone on for 300 years. And today, everybody, they're totally borrowed up. Everybody's borrowed up. They got the whole third world into debt. And then they came back to us as the ultimate, the consumers of last resort or the borrowers of last resort. So then they got the prime borrowers, people who could actually afford mortgages, and when they ran through those, then they went to the subprime borrowers, and in order, it's all sort of desperate moves to keep this bubble going, but in order to get the subprime borrowers to sign, of course, they got rid of all the lending standards, and they wouldn't actually want those risky loans on their books, and so they sold them off to investors, and in order to get the investors to buy them, they protected them with credit default swaps. Supposedly protected them. These are actually just bets. They were sold as insurance, but there's no insurance reserve to pay them off. They weren't really insurance, and they weren't called insurance.
So is that why AIG put out all this insurance on these derivatives and everything else? Is that what basically happened, or what?
AIG is in trouble. Is that they got into the as Ben Bernanke said, they were allowed to operate as a hedge fund. Nobody regulated them out of it. So they were basically just speculating. They were just gambling. Credit default swaps are sheer bets. You don't have to own anything to play the game. All you're doing is gambling that some loan won't default, and then the party on the other side of the bet is gambling that it will default, or vice versa. So AIG was just sitting back and collecting premiums. They got into that game in 1998, and they've been the credit default swap game. So they were just sitting back collecting premiums. I read a thing about the person that persuaded AIG to do this, and they were convinced that they were just getting free money because real estate never goes down.
Right.
So they thought that they were selling protection against something that just wouldn't happen. I mean, you'd have your occasional default, just like you have your occasional fire when you sell fire insurance.
Right.
But the whole community wouldn't catch fire. But of course, that's exactly what did happen. And well, people know that there's no such thing as something that goes up forever, and especially at the exponential rate that housing was going up.
Now, I wanted to mention Hank Paulson. Now, Hank Paulson created this this mortgage nightmare through Goldman Sachs, didn't he? He came up with the idea on breaking up these mortgages, these subprime mortgages.
And he bundled them up.
Yeah, bundling them up, breaking them up all over the place so that, with good mortgages and bad mortgages and everything. Wasn't he responsible for coming up with that program?
I don't know that he was solely responsible, but he was certainly involved in creating the, what they call financial products, putting together those, it's like
the subprime
debt options that we heard about a year ago or so, that were a combination of it's a mortgage-backed security, so they're selling off securities, which is like selling off stock.
Right.
Or selling off bonds, but they're backed by a mortgage. They're collateralized. That's why it's a collateralized debt obligation. But you know, but these were dodgy mortgages. They were mortgages you wouldn't want, or you wouldn't want to buy. You wouldn't want to underwrite that loan because the borrowers didn't necessarily have the money to pay. So these mortgage-backed securities were wrapped in a derivative, which supposedly protected them against default. And that was where the snag was in the whole scheme, because the derivative thing was a scam. There was no, that in itself was a Ponzi scheme. So there was no money backing it. Nobody checked to make sure that the money was there. It was typically the counterparty would be a hedge fund, or it was AIG, for instance. But so the hedge funds are just gambling. They're just outright gambling. They're just, they go to their broker, whoever, and they say, you know, we need to increase our income by a couple $100,000 this year. What should we do? And the broker says, well, you could sell some of these credit default swaps. And they say, sure, we'll do that. And then, you know, nobody really knows what they're getting into. They just know there's a certain element of risk, you know, and because they're assuming the risk, they're going to get paid better than, like, they wanted the high-risk things because they would pay better. So these hedge funds are just, they're assuming, oh, well, if we lose, we'll just go bankrupt. I mean, worst possible case, they put the shell through bankruptcy.
Well, you know what I laughed at?
The profit.
What made me laugh was, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. Back in, I was in real estate and finance for about 20 years, and back in the 80s, Dime Savings out of New York came up with this no income verification subprime mortgages, you know, and they wound up getting kicked out of the state of Connecticut because the default rate was so high and the fraud was so great that, I mean, people lost their home. I mean thousands and thousands and thousands. I mean, unprecedented number of foreclosures in this state and around in other states that they were involved with. In fact, I don't even know if Dime Savings of New York is still around. They might have gone under now. But back in the 80s, they were selling those things like crazy to everybody. It was a big boom because all you had to have was 25% down. And they didn't do any income verification for you, you know. And if you had fair credit, they gave you the loan, regardless of how much you applied for. So, you know, that brought down that bank and hundreds of thousands of people then, okay. But then they came back with that program. Obviously, they came back with it through other companies, picked it up through the subprime, and that's what caused this, you know, part of this collapse that we're dealing with now. It's just funny that it's an old system that failed was brought back to fail again, but only in a bigger way, you know.
But now the American taxpayer owns 80% of these banks by giving them money, and that could be a good thing, because don't you think? Because then we can own these banks.
Yeah, well, I think we should own 100% of the bank. That's the problem with Citigroup, for instance. We own 38%. We've already paid enough.
Mm-hmm.
Own every single share of stock because the stock has fallen so much. But instead, we own 38%, and we don't have control. They're still controlled by the same people, and the idea is we, the taxpayers, are going to be, because we're shareholders, we have to cough up the capital to clean up their books. And then when it's all cleaned up, we're going to hand it all back to the original owners.
I don't like that idea at all. Your idea.
What we should do is we should own the whole thing, and
mm-hmm.
we should get the profits.
And how? Oh, and
Citicorp, the CEO, it came out today. The CEO of Citicorp is getting a $10.8 million bonus. Did you hear about that?
No.
$10.8 million bonus goes to the CEO of Citibank or Citigroup. And,
they're getting paid for failure.
Isn't that wonderful?
Along with the $450 million that's going to AIG.
Maybe you could explain to our listeners why it would be a good thing if the American, if those banks were like public utilities, if they were owned by the government.
Well, for several reasons. First of all, if you have, well, in the 18th century, we actually had this ideal system. The ideal system was in Pennsylvania, and they owned a public bank. The government owned a bank. So So if it's the government that owns the bank, you can lend out money and the interest comes back to you, the principal and interest comes back to you.
Mm-hmm.
In order to. So first of all, you don't have that drain of the interest off into private coffers.
Right.
Besides that, because you are the government, theoretically you have the power to create money. I mean, that's who should be issuing money instead of the private Federal Reserve.
That's right.
Exactly.
Lending it to the government. The government, if the Federal Reserve were nationalized, the government could issue money directly. So it could issue a little extra to cover that interest. So you don't have this pyramid thing that's been going on all this time. You can actually do it. It's a mathematically sound system. You can, for instance, let's say you printed $105.
Mm-hmm.
In the Pennsylvania system, they lent at 5% interest. So you printed $105. You would lend $100 at 5% interest. Then you could spend that $5 on your expenses for the government. So you'd have $105 out in the system. It would all come back as principal and interest. Then you would never have to print again. You could lend that same $100, spend the same $5, and so forth. In the time that the Pennsylvania system was in place, they paid no taxes. The interest was sufficient to fund their whole government. They had no price inflation, and they had no government debt. It was perfectly self-contained.
What would it take, Ellen, what would it take for us to get to that point again? What would it take for us to be able to, nationalize these banks?
Well, you could just leave the law be. If you just quit bailing them out, the normal course for a bankrupt bank, the FDIC has three choices. First, the FDIC comes in, moves in as receiver on any bankrupt bank. This is the law. They've sidestepped the law with these bailouts. So the law is the FDIC pays off the creditors not with taxpayer money, but with the existing money of the bank, whatever it is. So the creditors stand in line according to seniority, and of course none of them gets what they are actually owed. They take a they all take a haircut. Some of them don't get anything, and that's just what a bankruptcy is. So then you've cleared the books. Then one of the FDIC's options is to nationalize the bank, take it over as a public entity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done that before, for example, with Continental Illinois, which was the biggest bankruptcy of the 90s. They actually came in and nationalized it. And they always do that in Europe. They nationalize the bank. But what is then done is after they get the thing going again, they give it back to the shareholders or sell it off to private owners. But I think what you should do, let's say it was Bank of America that went bankrupt. Bank of America has $38 trillion of derivatives on their books, and they are bankrupt. I mean, they could easily wind up in this process. So Bank of America has a branch in every single town. So you would just one bank, just nationalize one bank, would give you a public banking system for the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
And many countries have this. I mean, it's not unusual. India has public banks that operate right alongside private banks. It used to be that the private banks, they criticized public banks because they were just interested in pleasing the customers and they weren't aggressively out there trying to speculate and make money. Well, now everybody's fleeing the private banks and running to the public banks because they're the safe banks. They're the ones that...
Right.
And they didn't speculate, so their books are fine.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you had a federally nationalized banking system, would it make sense also for each state, like North Dakota has a state bank, would it make sense for each state to have a state bank?
Yes, well, I think they should. Some states have laws against it, but those are state laws. There's no federal law that says a state can't own a bank, and of course North Dakota does, and it has since 1919, so that shows that that's quite legitimate. And some states, for instance, Michigan has a law that says that you can only put half the state's revenues in the bank, in a state-owned bank. They have to be matched 50% by private investment. But that's fine. You know, you could set it up however you want. Anyway, the advantage of the state having a state-owned bank is that all the state's revenue, well, in North Dakota, all the state's revenues by law go into that bank. And then it does what every single bank does, which is leverage those reserves by a factor of 10 or so. In other words, it creates many times more credit on its books than it actually has money. So instead of paying the money you have, like California, we just don't have enough money to meet our budget.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of paying out that money, what you do is you take the money, put it in your bank as reserves, and then suddenly you have 10 times that much money as credit. So then you issue it as credit. You can pay off all your employees and so forth. And then it comes back So you initiate the money. Money is created there at the bank, and then it comes back paying off the debt rather than the other way around where you have to have the money first before you can put it out.
Right.
It just makes so much good sense.
Yeah, it does. And my question, again, is how can we... I've mentioned this to a number of people so far and about nationalizing the banks. The first word that comes out of the mouth is, oh, I'm not a socialist. No, we're not socialist, communist state. No. I can't agree with that, all right? And that, I can't even get past the first sentence, you know what I mean? What's been the response to the people that you've been speaking to or the reaction to your book?
Well, I have a remarkably good response. Maybe the critics don't bother to talk to me, I don't know, but everybody who writes to me is, you know, very excited about this whole other way of looking at things. I mean, people write to me, particularly from other countries. They get very excited because they don't have our... You know, they're not on the defensive like we are about our own banking system that's messed everything up.
Right. Yeah.
Now, you're from California.
Yeah.
Have you tried to encourage the politicians in your state to open a state bank? Had any success?
I gave a presentation in Tucson, and there was the man who introduced me was a... He had been a Goldman Sachs banker, and so he knew how to set up banks. And so he wrote a letter to Governor Schwarzenegger proposing that we do this and that he could set up a bank in the space of a couple of months. So it would be quite easy to do.
Yeah.
And of course, he got no response. So then I incorporated his letter in an article, and I think I got more responses from people, you know, reading that. And then people in Michigan, I guess they're legislators there. I also gave a presentation in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And on that last fall.
And they were very receptive, or no?
Yeah, they're particularly receptive because they're desperate. They're particularly when the auto industries go bankrupt.
Oh yeah.
The highest unemployment rate ever, in the country, and they're more open to. I mean, they're already trying to come up with alternatives.
Now in California, they're starting to issue IOUs and stuff, aren't they?
Schwarzenegger was talking about that because the parties couldn't agree, so they wouldn't pass a budget. But he finally did a lockdown basically and said nobody leaves until we pass this thing.
Okay.
And they did. Nobody was happy with it, but they did pass a budget to long enough to keep things going.
So do they have now? Do they still have that $48 billion deficit? Is that what they're looking at?
Oh, I don't know what the.
Oh, because they have $48 billion that they have as a deficit out there, but you are also the third largest economy in the world.
Well, that's another thing. North Dakota has a surplus. They have a $1.2 billion surplus.
I read that. That's fantastic, isn't it?
And they have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country, and have this great education system. Things. Well, and how they set that up? It was in 1919. There's a movie about it. I'm trying to get a hold of it. It's called Northern Lights. They were Scandinavian farmers, you know, up there in the bitter cold, trying to do their harvest in the frozen weather, and all their money was going to the railroad men and the Wall Street bankers.
Right.
So to protect themselves against that drain from their economy going out of state, they banded together and they formed something called the Nonpartisan League. I thought that was a great name because that's what we should do, you know, because there's all this, immediately people start thinking it's political or, you know, that you're a Republican or you're a Democrat or whatever, and that they're not in favor because they're not of your party.
Right.
So they all got together and they managed to pass this legislation.
And did they elect the populist governor too? Is that what happened?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. You're
heading
on that.
Oh, okay. I read that. But anyway.
Oh, Quinn had a... Maybe you're thinking of... but I can't think of his name. It was in the 20s. When they passed the law that allows Californians to bring an initiative.
Uh-huh.
So if you get 8% of the voters in the last election, 8% of the number of people who voted in the last election, to sign a petition, then the legislature has to put your bill on the ballot. For instance, that's how they got the hemp bill on the ballot. And then if the people vote for it, they have to do it, despite what the legislature thinks.
Oh, okay.
Well, do you think that's a possibility for a state bank then?
Yeah, I do, definitely.
Mm.
of course, it takes money. But that's the thing. You have to attract the. I mean, you don't. I know the people who did the hemp movement, and they didn't have money to start with, but they attracted some people who had
the money. Yeah.
Well, I would think the same people who supported that hemp bill would be very much in support of a state bank.
Yeah.
I think that'd be the same kind of thinking people.
Uh huh.
Well, maybe, but I know Massachusetts.
This is a different issue altogether. Not really.
Referendum. I mean, a lot of states have these referendums, and they go through and they become bills and they become law. And it's encouraging to know that we still have a possibility. I mean, we really do have a voice if we just exercise it, I guess. It made me laugh. Like today, the last couple of days with these executive bonuses. I mean, I'm figuring that the government must. I mean, every representative must have gotten a million emails. I mean, and death threats and everything else for them to come out and be so shaky and so worried about everything and suddenly lying through their teeth about what they did. We just read an article in Dodd, our senator Chris Dodd. He actually put an exemption in that bill so that they could get their bonuses, in the stimulus package. And now he's saying, no, they changed the wording on that. Well, that's bull. Everybody knew that they were going to get these huge bonuses, and it was perfectly fine. And in the Bush administration and then in the Obama administration,
yeah,
everybody knew about it. And now they're choking on it because there's nothing they can do about it,
Yeah, and their big argument is that, well, it's contract law, and don't want to breach a contract. Well, they didn't bring that up when it was General Motors. I mean, they certainly didn't mind breaking the contracts.
The union contracts and every other contract, right.
Right, and every bankruptcy, that's what a bankruptcy is, that you, everybody has to give up their things.
Right.
And big companies go through bankruptcy just so they can shake off the union. AIG should have gone through bankruptcy. The only thing keeping them out of bankruptcy is us, the taxpayers.
Yeah, and why they didn't,
right.
I mean, why we're doing that, we don't understand still. Nobody understands why we have to bail this company out.
Well, the bonuses are a minor thing. The bonuses are millions, but the billions are going to Goldman Sachs and the big counterparties to the AIG contracts. And so that's where the real scandal is, it seems to me, and that AIG is basically a money laundering thing where
for the bailout, I mean.
Right.
It's laundering the bailout money, right? Oh God. It gets dirtier and dirtier, doesn't it? It just seems to get. I mean, and we don't have anything. We can't do anything about it. What can we do about it?
Well, the good thing I think is people are getting very, very disillusioned. Where it used to be, originally when they held the gun to, certainly when they held the gun to the head of Congress, Congress said okay, they do it. Now everyone's getting very suspicious. So it seems to me there's the hope of change. The first thing you have to do before you can change anything is you have to have awareness.
Right.
Happening now.
I think it's great that the American public is outraged. I mean, they started their outrage with the large bonuses, and maybe they'll dig a little deeper, and through people like you, we'll all begin to understand really what's going on.
I think everybody's just got their just cringing and going, why are we bailing these guys out? They still don't understand this. I mean, and why should we honor these derivatives? These betting. I mean, if they're just all they were doing is gambling.
Dollar, and everybody else is getting. We all took like 50% haircuts in our stocks and our homes, etc.
Yeah, well, if I go to the horse track and I bet the farm, and my horse comes and it doesn't come in, I've lost the farm. I mean, that's basically what these guys did. All right, and
but they lost your farm.
But now they lost. Yeah, they lost everybody else's farm, but theirs, and they're getting. They're getting $450 million in bonuses.
For a poor job.
Yeah, and Lila was noticed today too. We heard tonight. What was it?
Eleven of the people from AIG that were getting bonuses don't even work there anymore.
Wow.
Because their defense is what they say back is, well, we need to give our economic talent, these people who got us into this position, we need to pay them to stay.
They've already left.
And they've already left, 11 of them. They left a sinking ship.
Yeah, so it's like.
But they get well paid as they go out the door or as they parachute out or whatever it is. From a crashing plane. I don't know.
But the reason that they're been doing one bailout after another. Did you hear Paul Kantorsky was on C-SPAN in January, I think, or February, and he said that the real reason for the bailout was that on September 15th, when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, Henry Paulson told Congress that there had been a $550 billion run on the banks, that much money had been pulled out of the money market funds in the space of 2 hours.
Whoa.
On September 15th, because it's something to do with the money market funds, you know, are supposed to be worth a dollar. They never lose, you know.
Well, isn't that when, wasn't it shortly after that McCain suspended his campaign?
I think it was that Friday.
Was it that Friday? Yeah, and suddenly everybody had to suspend their campaign to go to
the conference in Washington.
And then the next thing we know, we get a $750 billion bailout under the Bush administration. I mean, it's like, you know, with giving Hank Paulson, 100% control of it.
Yeah.
They were told
it was like a shot across the bow. It was like, this is what will happen if you let any of our big derivatives banks go bankrupt. Lehman Brothers was heavily involved in derivatives, so if they went down, all the counterparties would go down, all the people they bet with.
What would have happened if they did all go down? And just the FDIC would have covered all the losses and all the deposits. The only people that would have lost were the big were the guys who gambled.
Well, you would think, but. The argument is, for instance, their pension fund, there are all these things that have AAA ratings.
Right.
And if the credit default swaps aren't on them, they don't have AAA ratings. So suddenly everybody's assets go down. If a $550 billion bloodletting from the market in the space of 2 hours, they said the whole market would have collapsed if they had kept that up for another day or so. So, of course, everybody would be hurt if the stock market collapsed. But they didn't need to let Lehman Brothers go in that way. They could have done an orderly bankruptcy like they did with IndyMac. They could have stepped in and said, don't worry, we're protecting the money market funds.
But I read today also that one of the board of directors of not Citigroup, who is the company that bought out Lehman?
JP Morgan.
Yeah. One of the companies that I guess JP Morgan, one of their directors was also the advisor to a major advisor or a director also on Lehman Brothers. All right? No, Bear Stearns. Is Bear Stearns or Lehman?
Right.
Bear Stearns.
Amy Dimon is CEO of JP Morgan, and he sat on the board, sits on the board of the New York Federal Reserve.
That's right. And it was all,
billion.
I mean, what they did is they screwed this company. I mean, they just screwed it royal. And Barbara, just destroyed the company, just tore it apart and took all the assets.
Mm-hmm. And so that's clear insider conflict of interest.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely right.
Nobody with the power to step up and bring the lawsuit. I mean, there was Elliot Spitzer, and he got, you know.
That's
they took care of him, didn't they?
Yeah.
But I'm sure they have something like that on everybody, and they're, I would guess, and they're just ready to step in with their little scandal as soon as somebody steps out of line. Or if it's somebody as clean as a whistle that you can't find anything on them, they make them sound, look, ridiculous, or something like Dennis Kucinich and Paul, you know, they
people get marginalized.
Yep. It's a sad system. But again, do you think that we have any shot? I mean, is there any chance that we could possibly get one or two or 10 or 100 states to start their own?
I think if one state did it and it. Well, it worked. I mean, of course, North Dakota is doing it, but they've been doing it. But if you had one state that just turned itself around and suddenly was booming, whereas before it was bankrupt, Michigan. Just imagine if Michigan actually had the credit to turn GM around, you know, and give GM enough money so that it could produce something that it could sell, change it over to something besides SUVs.
Right.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
But all that just takes investment. And what is investment? It's only credit. All you're doing is saying, we believe in you, basically. You know, here's So we're going to front you the money, and you go out and pay the workers and buy the resources and build something and sell it and pay us back.
And we're the same country that we were before all this happened. We work harder than practically any other country.
Definitely. Yeah.
And we don't get the benefits that other workers get, other from Western Europe. They have cradle to the grave, and they don't have to worry about things the way Americans do. I think Americans work very hard. We're a very creative people. We come up with a lot of good ideas, and
we were fine. Like just a few years ago, people are saying, "Oh well, we're out of resources, you know, and we have to." It just can't be fixed, that there's not enough for everybody. But we had resources a couple of years ago. What the only thing that went down was the credit system.
Right.
And if we rebuild this credit system, we can be...
Well, first,
again.
Yeah. First
and it went down because it was a bad system.
Right.
Yeah, not only that, they gouged us with gasoline.
Yeah, and that's just sheer speculation.
That's right.
Lying from one thing to another.
And grabbed us, cut us off at the knees, and then all of a sudden the credit crunch came, and they just hit it.
That was the knockout punch.
Yeah, you know, and now you've lost what a 4 million jobs or something in the last in the last 6 months or something like that. I heard that tonight, and it's continually going, but. What can stop the bleeding here? What could really stop the bleeding would be to nationalize the banks.
There are four ways we could form our own credit system. But we have to have another system in place because you can't just let... I mean, they're right. You don't want to just collapse the banking system and have nothing.
Right.
So, but what you want to do is move over into another system and just let that one collapse. You don't have to prop it up and you don't have to abolish it. Just let it go because it's non-functional.
Right.
So you could set up your own credit, a public credit system. The direct approach would be to nationalize the Federal Reserve, and then you would have the Federal Reserve would be the government's own central bank, which could issue money for the government rather than lending money to the government as a private entity that takes the money back.
Right.
But that would be controversial and it might be hard to get past Congress. So number two, the most immediate and easy thing to do, I would think, would be to form some state banks because you're just forming a bank like anybody's entitled to do. There's absolutely no reason they can't set up a bank and do what every other bank does, which is create credit on their books. And they have plenty of resources to use for reserves if they use their government revenues like North Dakota does.
Now, what would happen? What would happen to the regional banks and the private banks in the state? I mean, you would think they would lobby like crazy against that.
Not in North Dakota. The Bank of North Dakota sort of serves like a Federal Reserve. It's the central bank of the area, and it partners with the private banks and it helps them. And so it's a source of credit for them when they run out of credit or have credit problems. So
right.
It's a good thing. It helps the other banks.
So it does. So you can actually marry the two of them together and live happily ever after.
Right. So there are four things that could be done. Nationalize the Federal Reserve, form state banks, actually nationalize these big bankrupt derivatives banks, take them over as public entities. And the fourth thing would be you could use the Federal Reserve as a public funding agency even though it's private because the Federal Reserve rebates all the interest that it gets from the government after deducting its costs, which are marginal. It's like 15% of their cost. And the reason they do that is in the 60s, Wright Patman was the head of the House Banking and Currency Committee, and he peered closely at the Federal Reserve and was shocked at what he saw, that it was a private corporation merely printing money and lending us the money and then charging us interest for it.
Yeah.
So there was obviously something crooked going on here. So he agitated to nationalize the Federal Reserve. Well, he didn't succeed, but what they did do was they quietly agreed to rebate the interest because obviously that wasn't fair. There was
no, you have to explain this again. They rebate the interest. So the interest that we're paying them, they pay back to us?
Yeah. So if you sell your bonds to the Chinese, who are getting reluctant to buy our bonds anyway, and they're running out of money to buy our bonds,
right.
They want interest and they want assurances and collateral, and they may come and collect one of these days. But if you sell it to the Federal Reserve, they'll give the interest back to you, and they'll roll those loans over indefinitely. The federal debt is never, ever paid off. It hasn't been paid off since 1838, and it's gone up exponentially since World War II. So a debt that's never paid off and that you don't pay interest on is the same as issuing money.
I see.
You reach the same result without...
Right. I understand this.
That's making sense.
But there are many, many hands in the pot, and the Federal Reserve is still making money, major money. But, I mean, even if it's rebating its interest, somehow it's making...
Well, they certainly pay their costs, and I'm sure they live well on their 15%. But the real benefit...
So they're getting 15%?
Yes.
That's what they're getting.
Well, they save out 15% of the interest, and the interest is only like 3%.
Right.
So we're only paying like about under 0.5% for that money. But still, the Federal Reserve, I'm sure their offices are plush and they have...
Yeah, very, very much so.
And they control everything.
Right.
Yeah, but the real benefit to the banks of the Federal Reserve is what the private banks get. They don't rebate the interest when they buy federal bonds.
Right.
They're actually getting paid interest on... The Federal Reserve has took their government bonds that they had. They had $850 billion in assets, most of which were federal bonds about a year ago. And so... Or I think in 2007, then in summer of 2008, they reported that they only had half that many federal securities, but they still had the same assets. So what they had done was trade their good U.S. bonds for this dodgy collateral on the bank's books and counted that still as assets in there on their balance sheet. But so we are paying interest to these private banks to hold our bonds and we get to keep the dodgy collateral as well.
I read an article, we're just about out of time, but I had read an article tonight about the IMF posing to print billions of dollars in global quantitative easing, it's called. And this is, they're going to issue a super currency, the IMF, to give to other countries, I mean, around the world, to ease the global credit crunch, okay? What would you, and of course there's a fear that that's going to cause tremendous inflation, but I still yet, I'm not sure what kind of a super currency they're going to issue. They stated it'd be dollars, but it's beyond dollars.
They have for a long time issued a form of, they're called SDRs, which are special drawing rights, which is a sort of its own currency. But the trouble with special drawing rights is that nobody trades in special drawing rights. They actually want dollars or whatever. They take their special drawing rights and trade them in for dollars, which means we're still on the hook for the money.
We're still there, yeah. Yeah, that's what I'd be afraid of.
Dollars. But if they really did issue a new currency and lent it, that actually would be a good thing, except that I wouldn't necessarily trust the IMF. I mean, the trouble is that they're...
Well, they're owned by us, so...
They're controlled by the big banks. They're not...
I think we own 58... Yeah, we own 51% of that, don't we? Or more of the IMF.
Could be, yeah.
Yeah, I think we're 71%.
The little countries have very little...
Unfortunately, we've come right to the last second of our show.
And we'd love to have you back on, Ellen. I'll give you a call, and maybe we can set up another time to have you on.
Okay.
You were great. Very informative.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for helping us all understand our economic mess and some of the good solutions.
And your book is called The Web of Debt.
Mm-hmm.
And you can check out webofdebt.com as well, which is,
or you can get it on Amazon. It's a bit difficult to get.
Okay. Amazon.com.
Okay. Will it be in bookstores?
Soon it will, because I'm doing a regular print run. But up until now, it was it's print on demand, lightning source, so they're going to be reluctant to carry it.
Okay.
Very good.
Well, thank you so much, and keep on educating.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen.
Have a good night.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. That was Ellen Brown talking to us from California about her book, The Web of Debt, and her understanding of the economic collapse and what the solutions are for that.
Yeah.
And we're right to the end of our time, Leo.
Yes.
And thank you for being with us, and I hope you tune in next week, same time, 8 to 10, and share your evening with Leo and me and our fascinating guests on the L.A. Steel Show.
Yeah.
All right, I want to thank everyone for joining us, and that was Ellen Brown on her book called Web of Debt, and check her out. You can go to her website, too, webofdebt.com. And you can read a number of her articles there and possibly pick up a copy of her book. And we thank everybody for joining us tonight. And please, you can join us tomorrow night, and same time, same place, and Friday night. with George Dixon. Tomorrow night we'll be discussing some other more esoteric areas of knowledge, and we'll talk about it then. Last week we did some tarot reading, we'll discuss that tomorrow night. So look forward to seeing you tomorrow night and Friday, and thank you for joining us, and have a pleasant evening. Good night.